Chris, the mayor, is here along with Chief Manning and Chief Gates, and let's listen.
Just received a briefing from Fire Chief Don Manning and from Police Chief Darrell Gates. We will go into those matters in just a moment. I first want to express my concern about the verdict of yesterday afternoon. I expressed my outrage and my shock at the verdict. Others have done the same.
That's L.A. Mayor Tom Bradley in 1992 reacting to the verdict exonerating LAPD officers in the beating of Rodney King. We're going to talk more about the legacy of L.A.'s first and only black mayor later on the program. But first, another LAPD use of force case, the shooting of Ezell Ford last August, has divided the police chief and the police commission. It has also stirred up old questions about LAPD policing, its relationship to the community, and the role and authority of the police commission. Joe Dominic is associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Madeline. Good to be here.
Nice to have you. Well, Chief Beck says the shooting and killing of Ezell Ford was justified under the circumstances. The police commission disagreed, found the actions of one officer unjustified, at least. Why did they come to different conclusions?
Well, I think they came to different conclusions because they were looking at the case from different standards. In 2013, the California Supreme Court ruled that under state law, the totality of the circumstances in a shooting, such as what happened with Mr. Ford, must be taken into account, not just the moment the officer decided he had to pull the trigger. And Beck made his decision, I think, based on that old criteria, and the commission made their decision based on the new standard. And their ruling that the lead officer, Wampler, did not have a reason to stop Ezell Ford in the first place, I think is what's really significant about this case.
Right. And that contradicts what Chief Beck had said, that he did have a cause because it appeared that he may have associated with gang members and gotten some drugs from them.
Well, I mean, you know, of course, the police are always going to try to have a justification for something unless it's so outrageous that they can't justify it. And, you know, Beck, I don't think, would try to justify something he considered outrageous, but I don't think he considers this outrageous. I think he considers this, part of doing the job.
So the commission said, no, there actually wasn't any cause for Ezell Ford to be stopped by the officers?
Absolutely.
And that was the major mistake, that's what started this cascade of events.
Exactly.
And what about in the moment, the struggle for the gun and all that? Was that addressed?
Yes, that was addressed. And the commission agreed that, you know, at that moment that he was shot, that was justified.
Okay, so what does this mean now if the two are...
What I think it means, the important thing I think it means is that this is really a challenge to stop and frisk in Los Angeles. Now, the LAPD has always used stop and frisk and used it very, very frequently, but they didn't call it stop and frisk. When Bill Bratton became chief in 2002, I don't know if you were in town at this time, but he said when he came to Los Angeles, I don't want those officers, you know, standing out on the street or in their patrol cars just waving as they go by. So in other words, he wanted them to get out and be what Darrell Gates used to call proactive, and that meant stopping people and questioning people, just as Ray Kelly was doing in New York. And during the Bratton years, the NYPD the LAPD proportionally was stopping as many people as the NYPD was doing. And they still continue to do so. And really, if they're stopping people all the time, many times they have no probable cause. They're just doing it as a control mechanism. And I think that this is a challenge to policing in that way. And Charlie Beck really believes that stop and frisk is essential for maintaining law and order, even though we saw in New York when Bratton reduced stop and frisk by 79% in 2014 that the crime rate went down crime rate went down at the same time that stop and frisks almost disappeared in New York.
Although the news now is that crime has gone up, at least homicides have gone up in New York significantly.
Well, what Bratton said is that homicides have gone up in New York, and the city is no less safe, that they're happening in a particular precincts, as the result of a kind of a drug war with the heroin epidemic in the Northeast. These guys are shooting it out to figure out who's going to take over and who's going to be the big cheese on the block.
So it doesn't have anything to do with slowing down the stop and frisk policy.
Well, it's too soon to specifically say that. What we know is that in 2014, by reducing it 79%, and Ray Kelly in 2013 had already reduced stop and frisk by 30%, that crime still went down, both in 2013 and 2014.
What about here in Los Angeles? You say that stop and frisk is alive and well here. What does that mean for the crime rate?
Well, one of the problems is we don't know how effective stop and frisk is because no study has really been done on it. But mm-hmm. but the only proof, and the reason that is the NYPD would never allow a study to be done on about it under Ray Kelly. So we don't know. We just have this, we have these 2 years in New York to look at. You know, it could be that it's effective, and we'll see crime go up permanently as a result of that. But right now, we don't know.
And what about officer-involved shootings or incidents of violence? What's going on with that here in Los Angeles with regards to stop and frisk? I don't know if you can link the two.
Well, yeah. I mean, the link between the two is exactly what happened to Ezell Ford. Mm-hmm. He was walking down the street. Now, there's all sorts of, making all sorts of justifications for why they were doing that, why they stopped him. But essentially, he wasn't doing anything. He was just walking down the street. He was a black guy walking down the street in a neighborhood where there's some drug dealing. And they stopped him, and it wound up that he died. So that's the link. Under stop and frisk, officers are constantly making stops. Many times the person that stopped hasn't done anything and they know it, and a confrontation ensues.
The Los Angeles Police Department, though, has been overhauled since the bad old days of the 60s, 70s, mm-hmm. 80s, and 90s, with a 2001 consent decree mm-hmm. after the Rampart scandal. Mm-hmm. And do you think that the department has significantly improved when it comes to negative interactions with the public, with violent interactions, with officer-involved shootings?
I think they have. And I think some proof of that is, as I mentioned earlier, that the LAPD was doing an enormous amount of stop and frisks, as was the NYPD. In New York, it became a tremendous confrontational issue, so much so that the new mayor got rid of it. In Los Angeles, because the LAPD was not being so confrontational, was not being so nasty, was actually, following Miss Manners' book. And that really had an effect. But it's still stopping an awful lot of people. And the LAPD it proportionally has more shootings over a period of, I think, 2007 through 2012 than cities like New York or Philadelphia or Chicago.
All right. So now Chief Beck has to decide on how to discipline Officer Wampler. And obviously he's already found that this was a justified shooting. What do you think is going to happen now in the wake of this commission finding?
Well, it will be very, very interesting, Madeline, because I think that Charlie Beck is really going to has really placed himself in a box. You know, Beck is an interesting guy. He was the real thing. He is an anti-gang cop. He had a partner die in his arms in South Bureau, and he has a lot of sympathy for the situation that cops find themselves in. And I think if he's going to err, he's going to err in favor, usually, of the cop, unless it's just a stupid shooting, a mean shooting, then he won't defend that. But if he thinks it's an error, the cop made an error, in tactics, like these guys made an error with Ford in the tactics that they use, he wants to retrain them. He doesn't want to destroy their careers for what he considers making a mistake. The reason he's going to be in such a bind is that's what he believes. And now it's come down to a leadership issue, because that's what the guys on the beat believe as well. And if he decides that the punishment is going to be very light, that's going to cause a lot of problems for him in the city.
You know, the motto for the LAPD is to protect and to serve. What do you think the general attitude is amongst the rank and file, amongst the beat cops, when it comes to dealing with people in the community?
It depends on which community you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think that in South Bureau and other places, Charlie Beck did an incredible community policing job in South Bureau, which is Watts and South Central, et cetera. So the LAPD is trying to do some of that kind of policing. Their mission used to be to suppress all those poor people, all those black and brown poor people. They got to be suppressed. That was their mission. Now they have a dual mission, I think, as a result of Beck and Bratton, which is suppression, as well as trying to get some legitimacy within the community to police. And homicides don't get solved in L.A. and many other ghettos across the country because the people there won't talk to the police. They won't give them any leads. So it's important that a police legitimacy exist, and that the police really do get the permission of the people that they're policing to police.
But what happens when you have an Ezell Ford shooting is, among some members of the community, that trust is eroded. And so how does that make it more difficult to do that kind of policing?
Well, obviously, it makes it more difficult. I think it's, for example, in South Bureau, Beck built up a lot of trust in the Bank of Goodwill. And I'm sure over the years that served him well, because we haven't had major demonstrations up until recently.
All right, Joe, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to speak to you, Madeline. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Joe Dominic, Associate Director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's also the author of a forthcoming book called Blue, the LAPD and the Battle to Redeem American Policing. It comes out this August. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think? Do you think the police need to be trained to operate differently on the streets? What do you think of the results of the investigations into the Ezell Ford shooting? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page or tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, well, as we just talked about, the police force was overhauled after the Rodney King riots, after the Rampart scandal. Tom Bradley was mayor for 20 years, two decades, the longest serving mayor in LA's history. We're going to talk about how he shaped the city, reshaped the city, next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play, and I'm Madeline Brand. We started today's show talking about the uneasy relationship between the police and the people they're supposed to protect and serve. LA has a long history of strong-arm policing, but even though significant problems persist, the LAPD has come a long way. In the 1950s, the city was mostly white and largely conservative, still a bit of a provincial backwater. The police chief was William H. Parker, who ran an often brutal and racist police force.
Bill Parker did clean up the department in terms of its corruption, but allowed a different kind of corruption, which was to be as brutal as you needed to be.
Parker could never say Negro, you know that. He's nigger. He ran the department just like J. Edgar Hoover ran the FBI. He's a dictator.
The mayor in the 1960s was Sam Yorty. From the Midwest, he called the city Los Angeles. Yorty refused to accept federal funds to improve the poorer parts of the city, and that, along with the police brutality, created the anger that would ultimately explode in 1965 in Watts.
To me, it is utterly ridiculous and try and blame the chief of police and the police department for the lawless conduct that took place here. It was the Negroes attacking the whites. You'd think from the talk here today that it was the police department attacking the Negroes.
But change in official Los Angeles was already happening. 2 years before the riots, three black men were elected to the all-white city council. One of them would go on to become mayor. His story, which is really the story of modern Los Angeles, is told in a new documentary.
In 1973, Tom Bradley, the son of sharecroppers and grandson of a slave, made history. He was elected mayor of Los Angeles, the first African-American mayor in a major American city with an overwhelmingly white majority.
Bridging the Divide, Tom Bradley and the Politics of Race will screen this weekend at the L.A. Film Festival. Lynn Goldfarb is the director, along with Allison Sotomayor. And Lynn's here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Along with Lorraine Bradley, Tom Bradley's eldest daughter. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let's begin before he was mayor, and he started his career as a police officer, right, Lynn?
Yes.
Would he have been content to stay within the LAPD if it hadn't been so racially segregated?
Well, certainly from all of our, you know, work and research and talking to people, the discrimination in the LAPD was something that really motivated Tom Bradley to leave. He was there for 21 years, but he was told that he would never become a captain. And so he decided that he had to get out. And he was a lieutenant, and he was one of only four African-American lieutenants at the time. And he went to law school. And so when he decided to leave the LAPD, he already had his law degree and was equipped to take new steps forward.
And then he becomes a city councilman, and then he runs for mayor against Sam Yorty. What was that like for you growing up, Lorraine, when he decided to enter politics? What was it like for your family?
Well, the first time, it was an exciting time. We walked precincts on the weekends. That was fun, going from house to house and getting very positive responses. The most disappointing, obviously, in 69 was the fact we didn't win, and we just thought that we had done everything to make that happen. But it was, as I said, an exciting time because we could see that the community, the public at large was excited. We hadn't seen that in a while.
And Sam Yorty, though, ran a really dirty campaign, right?
He called very your dad racist, dangerous. Very racist, yeah. Very negative campaign.
What did he think of Sam Yorty? What did he say privately about Sam Yorty?
The fact that he was a terrible mayor. He did nothing. L.A. was stagnant. We were still only the third largest city. You had a capacity for growth. Everybody wanted to move here, but what were they going to move here for?
And Lynn, he loses that campaign in 1969, but 4 years later he wins by a landslide. So it's a reversal in just 4 years in terms of his support versus Sam Yorty. What changed in those 4 years?
Well, I think the first time when he ran in 69, the fact that the Watts riots had been only 4 years before, I think still was in people's minds. And Sam Yorty manipulated that information and used it to scare people. One of the things that's always interested me about this story is when you think of 1968, 1969, the political turmoil, you know, the anti-war movement, the, you know, black power movement, the, you know, the riots, the police brutality that was there, and what it took for Tom Bradley to decide to run for mayor, totally unprecedented. There were no other African-American mayors in any major city. So the fact that he decided to run was incredible. 4 years later, the country had calmed down a lot. Watergate had happened. There was a lot more of a feeling of reform. And Tom Bradley fit exactly in the, you know, in the mode of the country. But he also built a coalition. You know, the black population in L.A. was 18%. in 1973. So there's no way that Tom Bradley could have won unless he built a coalition across all races, all ethnicities, and that's what enabled him to win, and that's what enabled him to govern in the way that he did.
Well, as with President Obama, a lot of African Americans had high hopes for Tom Bradley and what he would do for them. And
exactly.
Some were disappointed that things didn't improve as quickly as they had hoped, or at all in some cases. And so how did he respond to that criticism?
He continued almost every few months. He went out into, they selected a community, and they spent the entire day in the field. Mm. And because of this coalition building and the primary focus for any mayor was who he set on commissions, because they're the ones that did the work of the city, truly, and the city council. And he had a good relationship with city council people. And so a lot of things got done. Not everything is going to happen, no matter what you try to do. You can't move heaven and earth when it's not possible, but you can at least try to assist people in their lives.
And so what were his major goals for Los Angeles at the time? What did he want to accomplish? And what did he accomplish?
Well, I think one of the major things that he did want to accomplish was to really make LA a city for all people. And he did bring all minorities and women on commissions. And he hired them in City Hall and in really responsible positions. And once you change who is government, who is making the decisions, it really changes a lot of what policies are enacted and what the priorities are. He also started our whole subway system. One of the other things that he did, that which is critically important, is the Olympics.
In 1984.
Not only did he bring the Olympics to Los Angeles, but he changed the way the Olympics were run. Up until the point that LA had the Olympics, they had to be funded by public funds. Tom Bradley made a stand and said, we want to do the Olympics, but we want it funded by private business so we won't bankrupt the city. And he did it so successfully. And he had to stand, you know, they faced off against the IOC. And finally, Tom Bradley won. But LA made a profit with the Olympics. And the profit actually is still funding youth sports today.
Hmm.
So he kind of changed the whole dynamic of how the Olympics were run and showed that they could be run successfully. And that was a great accomplishment. It was a game changer in the history of the Olympics. I mean, he changed the whole dynamic of Los Angeles. Los Angeles was not an economic powerhouse when he came in. Los Angeles was not seen as a major city. And Tom Bradley changed all that.
And then 1992 and
yes.
Rodney King. And what was his reaction to that? I know publicly he was furious at the verdict.
He was furious with the verdict, but more importantly, he was so disappointed. They had set up all of these communities. He had worked with community leaders, church groups. If the verdict didn't come the way they had, would hope it, that they would produce a guilty verdict, that these community groups would be sent out to try to calm the waters and prevent what eventually happened.
He had had a terrible relationship with Daryl Gates. They hadn't spoken for a year before the riots. Daryl Gates, interestingly, I learned from your documentary, was Chief Parker's driver. So similar personalities, and he had clashed with Chief Parker when he was a policeman. Do you think at all, Lynn, that exacerbated the problems in the neighborhood, that there was that tension between the executive, the chief executive, and the police chief?
The problem really was that Daryl Gates really thumbed his nose at the mayor, and Mayor Bradley realized or knew that he could not do as much as certainly he wanted to do because he had no, you know, authority, you know, over Chief Gates. So because there's no civilian control, he's protected, you know, by civil service. I think some of it was personal, but I think it was really a different vision of what the police, what role the police should have in the city. And when you saw how the police operated, and it, you know, I mean, when you look at what's going on today, you know, around the country, you can just really see what happens today as then when the police have no accountability.
So he ran for governor in the 1980s
yes.
against George Duke Majan.
Yes.
And everyone thought he was going to win. The polls suggested he would. And then he lost. And then, and hence the term the Bradley effect.
That's exactly, unfortunately, that's true. And people, when they went into to vote, just couldn't mark the ballot that way. He took it hard. Next morning, he got up. We had breakfast at the hotel. He got up and went back to work.
What was he like as a dad?
Oh, he was terrific. When we were growing up as little kids, he did everything. He's who taught me to drive, made sure I knew how to parallel park, because at the time that was the hardest issue about driving when you took the test. Did all the things a dad is supposed to do. He was there with us when we were growing up. We had all the did all the trips, did all the activities. We missed out on nothing. He was just a great dad. I tell people, and I said in the video, I said, you've seen if you're old enough, you've seen the series called Father Knows Best. It's truly ours, the Huxtables. It's our family.
20 years as mayor.
Yes.
The longest serving mayor
yes.
of Los Angeles.
Yes.
So.
And no one else can, there's a term limit now to the office, so he stands to hold the record.
What do you think his major regrets were?
Well, obviously, the uprising in 92 would be one of them. The fact that no matter how much you try to do, you just can't do enough. You can't do everything.
What is Tom Bradley's most important legacy, Lynn?
I feel that Tom Bradley's most important legacy is really the transformation of Los Angeles. For me, when I grew up in L.A., prior to Tom Bradley becoming mayor, I remember L.A. as being provincial, white, conservative city. And I think he is the major person that transformed L.A. into the dynamic, multicultural, world-class city that we are today. And he did it both by changing people's minds, but changing them by example, and changing it by encouraging people of all colors and, you know, women to be in visible positions, to have positions of authority, to be able to influence policy. And that helps change a city.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in today.
You're welcome. Pleasure
thank
to
you.
Be here.
That's Lorraine Bradley, Tom Bradley's eldest daughter, and Lynn Goldfarb, director of the new documentary Bridging the Divide, Tom Bradley and the Politics of Race. The premiere of the film is this Sunday. It's sold out, but an additional screening has been added on Tuesday at 4 o'clock downtown at the LA Live Regal Cinemas. You can go to lafilmfest.com for details.
I've served a record 5 terms as your mayor. Others should now have the opportunity and the responsibility to bring their vision to bear on the future of this great community. I am prepared to pass the torch to new leadership.
Coming up on the program, the Murdoch Empire looks secure. Rupert announced he's handing the reins to 21st Century Fox over to his sons. We're going to find out what that will mean in Hollywood with Kim Masters after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play, not 21st Century Fox. I'm Madeline Brand. Rupert Murdoch is reportedly handing over the control of 21st Century Fox to his younger son, James. James will oversee the movie studio and the TV business. And to talk about this succession and what it may mean for the company, we're joined now by Kim Masters, editor-at-large at The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Hello.
Hello.
All right. So Rupert is 84 years young, and this succession plan, not entirely out of the blue. Did he always want James to take over for him?
Actually, it's James and Lachlan. They are stressing his two sons. He has four daughters, two of whom are grown-ups, but we'll
we're talking about the young princes in the Murdoch kingdom here. So James has been, you know, chosen, and some people are perceiving James as the lead, as the alpha in this pair.
Yeah.
But if you want to listen to what people at the company say, they are going. James will run the TV and film operation somewhat hand in glove with Lachlan. Lachlan, there are two companies. There is the TV and film and a separate newspaper company. That is Lachlan's domain. So Lachlan has been brought back. He was sort of in exile for a while. And supposedly, as I said, and none of this has been officially confirmed, I should mention, they're going to do this at a board meeting. They haven't even told us exactly when, but soon.
Sometime next week,
very
maybe.
Soon. But yes, James and Lachlan, don't get that wrong.
Okay, James and Lachlan. And they're only a year apart, right? 42 and 43.
They're very close
they're young,
in age, yes.
Very close. Are they close in other ways?
Well, I think they are going to be now.
Yeah.
I mean, Lachlan's been living in Australia, and James lives and will continue to live in New York. Lachlan is moving here to Los Angeles. So I think that, you know, this is what their father wants. He's not going away. He's a very vigorous 84, and he will be in the picture. Roger Ailes, who runs the Fox News Channel, has made it clear he's not reporting to either of these kids. He's reporting to Dad still. So Rupert is in the game.
And he's still running News Corp, the newspapers.
He is still going to be, he'll come in as he chooses. You know, that will be what he does. But he is cementing that these two young men will be the heir to the Murdoch empire. And you have to admire the seamlessness. You know, a couple of years ago, this company was in such a mess. And James, it looked like God knows what was going to happen. There was a hacking scandal. He was running the newspaper operation in Britain that was at the epicenter of the hacking scandal. He looked a little like not so good in all of that. Like he had to testify before Parliament. And, you know, it didn't look good. All of a sudden, that's all gone. Well, not all of a sudden, by design and gradually, that has gone away. James is rehabilitated. He booked on out of London. He came to the United States, and he has been resurgent for a while now.
Yeah, for a while there, during the, you know, when that whole phone hacking scandal was at high volume, it looked like this was the end for the Murdochs.
I mean,
both of them testifying.
Good. Yeah, it looked bad. And Wendy Deng, you might remember her blocking the pie when somebody tried to hit Rupert in that parliamentary testimony. You know, she was part of a tension within the family that spilled into the public eye. The kids weren't necessarily crazy about her. It was dividing the family. Well, she's gone. They've been divorced for a while now. So, you know, he has appeared, he being Rupert Murdoch, to restore, you know, this kind of Shakespearean order to the kingdom that and that's the way it's going to be.
Right. And speaking of Cordelia, Elizabeth, his oldest daughter, is
actually not his oldest daughter, but he had one of his two daughters. The other one has never been involved in the business. Elizabeth was. But she stepped out and appears to be content to remain out.
Okay. So this is unusual, right, that he has retained such a strong control. This is a publicly traded company and handed it over to his sons. Anyone objecting? Anyone saying, hey, maybe we should get an outsider in here?
I don't think that's – well, first of all, there is a COO. Chase Carey is gradually going to step aside now as COO. There's always been a very smooth – guy in a suit, very disciplined, very slick political guy. First, you know, in recent history, it was Peter Chernin. You know, this is like almost the Murdoch son who is never going to really be a Murdoch and ultimately moves on. But for a time, you know, the Murdochs always rely on this person. Then it was Chase Carey. It looks like it will eventually be Peter Rice, who is very much in that mold, British, very, very smooth political player, very disciplined, ran the film side, runs the TV side now. Obviously, that's grooming, so we should look for him to move up and be that guy.
So you're not expecting any major changes to 21st Century Fox. It'll be business as usual. And this is a successful company,
right? Will certainly be interesting to see to which degree Rupert lets the children have their way, and if there are clashes with other executives. I wouldn't clash with them if I were an executive at that company at 21st Century. But, you know, it could happen. It happened long ago with Lachlan. I think times have changed since then, though.
Well, what happens after Rupert dies? I mean, do the sons have the same kind of authority, gravitas that their father has?
That is the question. I mean, not now. You know, Rupert is a towering figure. But if you compare and contrast this company with another company that's controlled by a family, Viacom, you know, then you can really admire, however you feel about the Murdochs, and not everyone admires the Murdochs, you admire the way this was executed. I mean, Viacom is run by a quite feeble 92-year-old, and there's no succession plan that anyone can discern that makes any sense. Endless speculation. potential for all kinds of scenarios. And the Murdochs, I think, themselves would point to Viacom and say, look how much better we are.
Wow. Well, would they look towards a takeover of Viacom?
I think people do see Viacom, which consists of Viacom, which owns Paramount and Nickelodeon and MTV and CBS, which is part of the Sumner Redstone empire, as a potential takeover target. And that is, you know, when you look at the broader entertainment landscape, there are companies that seem like they are set, Disney and Fox being the two notable ones. And then there are companies like Viacom where it just seems like they're a little bit adrift and could easily be subject to a takeover, you know, and Time Warner even is in that category. So I think the herd thins. There's been a lot of talk about deals that will be aborning in the media space. Nobody thinks Fox is, you know, they tried to take over Time Warner already and were rebuffed, but they could possibly be having that in the back of their mind still. They could be looking at Viacom. There's all kinds of stuff that we will have to talk about, Madeline.
Right. Well, is that something that James is and Lachlan, are they ready to take on these deals?
Yeah, that will be the interesting show. I mean, they will have help, as I mentioned, and, you know, they're their father's sons, but are they really their father's sons? That's only time will tell. And as you know, they've been stressing internally, you know, Rupert Murdoch is not going anywhere. So he's going to be chairman still, and he's going to have his hand on the, you know, he's not going to let the boys go crazy, and he'll keep the, you know, his mother lived to be very, very old, so maybe he will too.
All right. Kim Masters, editor at large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Thank you.
Thank you.
Another KCRW luminary is here now, Warren Olney, to tell
Lights
us what's happening at 1 o'clock.
We are going to be talking about student debt in the United States, which has now reached a level of more than $1 trillion. I can't conceive of how much $1 trillion is.
It's just a lot.
But when it gets attached to student debt, you know, a lot of people are in trouble. Several, many millions of them. I forgot now exactly the number. And there's been an op-ed piece in the New York Times by a freelance writer who freely says that he defaulted on his student debt. He's glad he did, and he gives advice to other people. The New York Times has been accused of journalistic malpractice for just running that op-ed piece.
Because he has several Ivy League degrees, it turns out.
Well,
right?
He does. And it turns out, too, that, however, there are people who are saying, wait a minute, nobody's going to actually default because of his advice and counsel. That's not really what he had in mind, but he wants to start a conversation. So we're going to have part of that conversation.
Yeah, you know, we talked about that, about the moral hazard and whether or not it is ethical to default on your student loan or not, and if the loans themselves are ethical.
Yeah, you know, well, particularly given the setup we have now, and especially with the for-profit colleges like Corinthian, which is now, of course, going out of business, and the government is going to pay back $3.6 billion, or is prepared to pay back that much in student loans from people who, largely African Americans, who were defrauded, essentially, by Corinthian, if they can prove it.
Okay. Look forward to that very important conversation at 1 o'clock with Warren Olney on To the Point. Coming up on this show, Apple announced an overhaul of iTunes this week. We're going to find out what that means for you and some other tech news with Shani Jardin next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for our weekly tech segment. Shani Jardin is here as she usually is. Hi there.
Hi, when you're not floating around in space beaming high-speed internet back to Earth.
Oh, okay. You have been replaced by Elon Musk.
Apparently.
For this segment.
We all will be.
We're all pawns in his game.
Yes.
So what is his latest game? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Elon Musk, PayPal, Tesla, SpaceX, the idea of building a human colony on Mars. None of this is enough for him. Now he's got a new venture to beam broadband from satellites. And the idea that Musk has and that his company has filed with the Federal Communications Commission for approval, the idea is to put a whole constellation of satellites that will swarm through the sky beaming high-speed internet back to Earth.
Like
communication satellites, obviously, this is not new. This was a new thing in the 70s or 80s, maybe, but the idea of having broadband come from space is a thing this year. Richard Branson is also exploring that, as is Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, with these drones that would beam internet to less connected parts of the world.
As opposed to big fat cables or cell phone towers.
That's right. We're talking about infrastructure projects that take a long time and a lot of complicated equipment and a lot of money to do. And technology has advanced to the point where going to space is a viable and feasible idea. But even Musk admits that we're talking like 5 years to get all the infrastructure in place, maybe 15 years before it's really a feasible method of communication for a lot of people.
Now, we already have satellites. Mm-hmm. In space for communications. Mm-hmm. That's how we get a lot of our television programming and some of our radio programming.
Indeed.
How is this different?
The FCC filing talked about a low latency, global, high capacity internet service. And currently, let's say, you know, I've done this. You go to West Africa on a reporting trip and you have maybe a satellite phone. Perhaps you're tapped into a source of satellite internet. If you're in a place where there isn't cable over land or over sea to connect you to the high speed internet. Those services are really slow, and they're really expensive, and they're really unreliable. Most of our listeners have flown in a plane and tried to use that Gogo in-flight internet mm-hmm. service. And as magical as it is to be in a plane using the internet, the problem is that half the time you're not using the internet because the system's so terrible. Latency is sort of a fancy word for how long it takes a packet of data to go from one point to the other. I'll get internet arguments over that, but basically the point of this program, which is going to take a lot of money, a lot of time, and a lot of acceptance of risk for things failing, this seeks to solve that problem.
So he's trying to get FCC approval to do this.
That's right. And he's not the only one. Richard Branson's backing a company called OneWeb, and that's, I think, the most clear competitor to Elon Musk's project. And Facebook is experimenting with these solar-powered unmanned drones that would, but they're not talking about having those orbit the Earth from space. So these aren't all the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe in a few years we'll see one of them.
One of these rich guys is going to make this work.
Okay. Speaking of rich, let's move on to Apple, which announced a major overhaul this week of iTunes.
Yeah.
Finally.
About time, right? I was up in San Francisco at Moscone Center on Monday for the big announcement. It was very exciting to be there at the Worldwide Developer Conference. Apple does this every year, and each year the keynote is this big theatrical moment. And, you know, I've been going to these since the days of Steve Jobs. Well, this year, Tim Cook led the theater, led the circus, and it was exciting and fun. And one of the interesting things that came out of that is Apple Music. And Apple Music aims to be a lot of things for a lot of people. I would say that Apple's least popular product, hardware or software or service, is iTunes. People love to make jokes about yeah. how clunky and bloaty and how bad it is compared to newer services like Spotify or Pandora. I'm a big Spotify mm-hmm. user. And we won't really know what Apple Music is until they roll it out at the end of June. But what I saw on Monday really looks promising. Drake was there. Well, in that and case. Jimmy Iovine.
Done. Sold.
We were surprised that Dre wasn't on stage. But
so these are the Beats Music guys.
Beats Music guys. So Apple acquired Beats Music, Dr. Dre, Jimmy Iovine's headphone and music sharing empire.
Yeah, I remember when that happened and people were like, why do they need new headphones? What's wrong with the earbuds?
They weren't buying the headphones.
That's not what they were buying. Right. So how would this be different than Spotify? And could it take on Spotify's market share because they have 20 million users? That's
20 million users.
That's a lot.
Spotify's making a lot of noise this week in response to that announcement. I think this is a really interesting time. I can remember 20 years ago sitting around eating lunch with people who worked in the digital music industry, and we were all viewed as outsiders, and this was all seen as this kind of piratey hacker underworld that threatened the musicians. And now, who gets music any other way other than digitally? This is the norm, right? Streaming music is now the norm. It'll be interesting to see what happens when this service rolls out. Does this become primarily just an easier way to get all of your music in one place? Or does this really provide people with a new way to interact directly with artists? A big part of what Apple was pushing on Monday sounded a lot like Ping. Remember Ping?
No.
Remember when Apple launched the service called Ping maybe like 5 or 6 years ago? Uh-huh. And it was such a piece of poo. I mean, like they wrangled Lady Gaga into it and everything, but it was like this... It was this really badly designed service to connect artists and fans.
Okay.
Some of what Spotify does accomplishes that. Some of what RDO does accomplishes that. And I think they've scrapped products that are no longer regarded positively, but we still see some of that product DNA in what they teased on Monday with Apple Music. So we'll see.
So we don't know exactly what it looks like, but we'll find out June 30th.
We'll find out June 30th.
All right. So finally, a story from your site, Boing Boing. And so let's talk about Jason Weisberger. He is the publisher of your site.
He is.
He has a car with a vanity plate on it that says drunk.
He does. Jason is our publisher, but he's also a very funny guy. And he wrote this essay for Boing Boing about what it's like having a sports car with the license plate drunk. And he talked about driving up to his lovely daughter Hannah's school in Marin County. And the parents all sort of queue up at the curb and wait for the kid to come out of school. And a little girl, who was his daughter's age, pointed to the car and said to another child, "My mommy says that man's bad because he has a bad word on his license plate." And, his essay, which is really fun, you should all... visit Boing Boing and read it. It was just about how vanity plates are such a California cultural thing. Where else in America do people take vanity plates so seriously and try to tweak the rules of what the DMV will allow so that they can get by with plates like drunk? And this plate, by the way, was an homage to the great Dean Martin, whom LA residents might remember tooling around on Mulholland Drive at faster than legal speeds around dangerous curves with a license plate that read drunky. So Jason thought it'd be
cool. You know, a lot of people would say that's so uncool. People die in drunk driving accidents all the time. I mean, it's a terrible thing, and you shouldn't be promoting that.
You know, it's just this weird joke.
Yeah.
Jason doesn't actually drive drunk.
Yeah. I wonder if police will pull him over.
I think he's had some interactions like that, and he's also had interactions with people who think it's really offensive, but I think most of the interactions he's had are people who just think, wow, you just won the game at vanity plates. Like, A, you got that approved, and B, you're driving around in a blue Corvette.
And C, you're making fun of the whole process.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about a vanity plate that a friend of mine saw on a Tesla, speaking of Elon Musk. It said, "One Adonis."
Wow.
Yeah.
Single?
I would imagine that person will be single for a while.
And of course, now that cars are becoming a streaming service, not a download, just like Apple Music, and we're using services like Uber and Lyft more, maybe the days of the vanity plate are going the ways of the vinyl LP.
Oh, no. Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, thank you.
Hey, thank you, Madeline.
one Adonis. Anyway, Jolie Myers, hi.
I have to tell you that this is one of my favorite Los Angeles topics, vanity license plates. I can't tell you how much time I've sat in traffic just staring at the vanity license.
To decode
like,
it.
What does that say? There's always like 3/8 in it and like a Z, and it's like you're trying too hard. Okay, vanity plate, like knock it off. So we asked our listeners about the most ridiculous vanity plates that they'd ever seen. We got a pick from an anonymous fan. It reads 1 in Emmy, like the number 1, but it's supposed to be 1 in Emmy. It's on a Toyota Avalon with a smoking gold detail package. It is pretty sweet.
It's the reason why they're called vanity plates.
Anyway. I know, right? Like, come on. You know what you're doing when you get one of those. It's spelled right out, unlike the plate itself. Sumo Remedy tweets that he once saw a vanity license plate that said swag, which pretty much guarantees that this person has about 0 swag total. Mel Ortiz tweets that her fave vanity license plate said EQ me, which she interpreted as excuse me in a Latino accent. Very Los Angeles
funny
there. And John Ennis says LICNSPL8, which spells license plate.
Excellent. I thought it was about lice. But anyway.
That's the one that I would have stared at for a while.
Jolie Myers, thank you very much. If you'd like to weigh in on your favorites, tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney, To the Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Adeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. Barbara Bogave in tomorrow, and I'll see you on Monday.